Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
All right, first, an official announcement. I am a step-uncle again. Last night, Jennifer Downs had a baby girl. Yay! Finally, I know. And so Brent called me last night quite excited and said, the baby's here and she's fine and mom is fine. Apparently it was like 10 minutes of pushing and girl. So it all went really, really well. 7 pounds, 9 ounces. Little girl doesn't have a name yet. So it's just baby girl Downs at this moment.
No, wait a minute.
No, I'm not
naming it. This close to Christmas, why don't they just go ahead and go with Blitzen?
Sure, why not?
Well, you know, they call my nephew Baby Boy Owen for the longest
time. That's fine. I think you got to look the baby in the eye for a little while and then figure out what the name is. So, yep. By the way, since you said Blitzen, this has nothing to do with anything, and we'll actually start in just a moment. But at your Christmas program Thursday night, The guy who read was the night before Christmas. You could tell he was from Middle Tennessee because he said, on Dasher, on Dancer, on Prancer, on Dixon. On Comet, on Cupid, on Donder and Blitzen. And I remember thinking, on Dixon? Is that like the substitute reindeer that week? Need a sub, get in here, you know. Exactly, Jose and Dixon and all the other reindeer that you don't usually hear about.
Do the Seven Dwarfs.
Sneezy, grumpy, dopey, doc, sloth, gluttony. Oh, Seven Deadly Sins. I'm sorry. Okay. Exodus 12. Exodus 12. We are talking about the deliverance of Israel out of the land of Egypt. Tonight we're going to talk about God instituting, establishing the Passover. And that name comes from the fact that the death angel is going to pass over. It's really not any more complicated than that. But this is an absolutely essential moment in Israel's history. It's one of the few times that God is going to say, now memorialize this moment. And as long as there is a nation of Israel, do this. And every year, to this very day, at Passover every year, the Israelites stop and observe the Passover Supper. Once we've kind of established what the Passover is historically here, it's going to be almost impossible not to talk a little bit about the Passover's influence on the Lord's Supper, which kind of gets into a little bit of why we even do communion the way we do. But it's also an essential element of God setting the stage for sending his son into human history and then making sure that his son dies on a particular day, at a particular feast, at a particular time, because God is so completely in control of the circumstances of human life, especially those places where his son is being glorified in the redemption of his people, that God is setting the stage 1,400 years in advance. There are three times on the Jewish calendar, the Hebrew calendar, the religious calendar, that every Israelite who can travel was told that they had to go to Jerusalem, and they had to keep what were called feasts. And actually, the Hebrew word doesn't mean a feast like go and sit and eat. It means a set time. It's a set time of the Lord. It's God saying, at this calendar date, at this period of time each year, in this cycle of the moon and the stars and the sun, everybody who is a member of Israel and can travel has to come here and appear before me three times a year. And this is the first of the feasts he's going to establish. Eventually, it is going to entail the first day, which is called the Passover. And on that day, they memorialize the night that the death angel passed over Israel. We'll get into all those elements as the night goes on. But then once they get to Sinai, God is going to say, now, Add to that a whole week-long feast, which he calls the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And during the week of that feast, no Israelite can have any leaven in their house, which is just basically yeast. And so you have to cook flatbreads. Yeast makes bread rise, makes bread puff up. And so yeast becomes a type of sin. The first day and the last day of that week-long feast are high holy days, big convocations. God calls them Sabbath days and says you won't do any servile work on the first day and the last day of that feast. So on the 14th day of Nisan, we're going to see that pointed out tonight, on the 14th day of Nisan is the Passover. On the 15th day of Nisan, it's a high holy day. It's the beginning of a seven-day feast. It's called the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And then the last day, the seventh day, high holy convocation. Somewhere in that week, regardless of what day of the week the 15th of Nisan falls on, somewhere in the course of that week, you're going to have a first day of the week. In other words, if that week-long feast goes Tuesday to Tuesday, there's a Sunday in there. If it goes Thursday to Thursday, there's a Sunday in there. Somewhere in that week, there's going to be a first day of the week. The first day of the week that occurs in the midst of the Feast of Unleavened Bread is then called the Feast of First Fruit. And so God is very clear to say that the Israelites are going to observe the Passover first, and they're going to have a Passover meal. And they're going to have it at the very beginning of that day. One more thing you need to know about accounting Hebrew calendar days is that they were on a lunar calendar. We're on a solar calendar. We count our days midnight to midnight. To us, that's a day. Right now, it's Wednesday, midnight tonight. We start calling that Thursday. Well, on a lunar calendar, you start figuring the next day based on the evening, which really our word evening to this very day means exactly that, an even amount of dark and light. We call that the evening of the dark and light. And so at that moment, when there's the even dark and light and the night is going into dark, that's the beginning of the next day. So if we were on a lunar calendar, even though it's Wednesday for us right now, it would technically be Thursday. Because at about 5 o'clock, 5:30 when the sun went down, that would be the beginning of the next day. So when I say they kept the Passover dinner on the 14th of Nisan, that's actually the evening of the 13th. You understand what I mean? Mm-hmm. On the evening of the 13th, just like how it's going to be established tonight, which is why I'm giving you all this grid that you can plug all these details into when we hit this chapter, on the evening they would keep the actual meal. And then during the next day, they would kill for all of Israel, the high priest would kill a Passover lamb for Israel nationally as part of a atoning and sin offering for Israel. And then the next day is the high day, that's the beginning of unleavened bread. And somewhere in that week there's going to be a first day, and that's the day of first fruits. You following all that? Mm-hmm. The reason all that's important is when we get to the New Testament, we find that Jesus, on his way into Jerusalem, one of the questions that he was asked by his apostles right away is, well, where do you want to keep the feast? They had to keep the Feast of Passover. They had to do it. Every Israelite did. Where do you want to keep the Passover? And so you probably know the story. He says, well, when you go into town, you're going to see a man. Follow that man. You're going to find out that he has an upper room fully furnished. Tell him the master has need for the room. Surprisingly, they go into town, and there's a guy. And he's got a room, and it's fully furnished. And they say the master has need, and they go into the upper room and keep the Passover. For them to be keeping the night of the Passover tells us that that's the beginning of Nisan 14th. It's the night of the 13th. We know what day and what time that would have been. That night, of course, Jesus is captured. That night, he goes through all the kangaroo courts as he bounces back and forth between Pontius Pilate and then over to Herod and then Herod back to Pilate. Over the course of that night, he's beaten and tortured and his beard's plucked out. And then the next day, as was the custom of Pilate, every year at Passover, he would give the Israelites back one of their captives, somebody that Rome had taken in, a criminal or something, and they would free one captive. So it was kind of a way of making nice with the Israelites. They'd give them back one. And the high priests were quite concerned, as we read in the Gospels, that one thing they did not want Jesus to do was die on Passover. This was very important to them. Do not let him die on Passover, because then they'll all just think he's a martyr, and then he'll be the fulfillment of yet another prophecy. We can't let him die on Passover. So despite their efforts to have that not happen, of course he died on Passover. So Passover is going from the night of the 13th to the night of the 14th, evening to evening, and so that afternoon, the afternoon of the Passover, as the high priest would have been killing a lamb for Israel, the one that John the Baptist identified as the Lamb of God that takes away the sin of the world, was outside the camp, outside the city walls, paying the sin price, becoming the culmination of the whole Passover lamb typification. He was put in the grave that night. That's why there was such a hurry. The Jews risked going and even talking to Pilate and begging the body from him, and you can read it in John's account. He said the reason they were in a hurry to get his body down off the cross was that the next day was a high day. Well, of course it was. It was the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. It's a high day. You can't do any servile work. So if they didn't get him off the cross by sundown, then they were going to have to go and keep that day, and another 24 hours was going to pass. Who knows what might have happened to the body. And so they beg the body from Pilate. Pilate's surprised to hear that he's dead. He sends out soldiers who would have broken his legs so that he would have stopped breathing and died. They were surprised to find that he was dead. To prove that he was, they pierced his side with a spear. Out came blood and water. And then Joseph of Arimathea took the body down and put it in his own tomb. And that night starts the high day, which is the beginning of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And then we know for sure from all of the gospel accounts that Jesus rose on the first day of the week. There's no ambiguity about that. So we know then that he rose right on the Feast of First Fruits. And so Paul later is going to call him the first fruit of the resurrection, because he resurrected right on the Feast of First Fruits. After the Feast of First Fruits, which happens on the first day of the week, the Israelites were told to count seven Sabbaths forward. So that'd be 7 weeks, 49 days. And then on the first day of the week after the seventh of those Sabbaths was what was called the Feast of Weeks, because you were counting weeks. And it was also called the Feast of Pentecost. Penta, 50, 50 days. And sure enough, Jesus died right on Passover, was in the grave right as unleavened bread began. And then he rose right on first fruits, and then exactly 50 days later, we've got Pentecost, the church is born, the Holy Spirit infills people, and there's the beginning of the infilling of the Spirit, the fulfillment of the new covenant promise. All of that occurs 1,400 years after what we're about to read, which means God is setting all that up all that much time in advance. You get what I'm getting at here?
Or it's just a big coincidence.
Or it's very lucky. God got really lucky. He told them to do this on the 14th of Nisan and then cross those great big eternal fingers. And fortunately for him, it turned out okay. So when you read Exodus 12 here, remember this is God setting the stage. Setting the stage for what he's going to do in his son yet to come. What do you think, by the way, since Rick just said, gee, that was fortunate and lucky, what do you think the chances were? If you just kind of do the math for a moment. What were the chances that Jesus would just happen to be born on such a date that he could be baptized when he turned 30 so that his ministry would be 3.5 years, so that he would die, that the year he died just happened to work out in such a way where going from dying on Passover to raising on the first day of the week happened to be 3 days and 3 nights? I mean, there are so many coincidences here. If you don't see the absolute sovereign hand of God in all this, you need to go back and reread the whole thing, because God is making it very clear and very precise that he's in charge of every minute detail of what took place in the redemptive work. Yes, sir?
So what day was he crucified on?
So you want to get into that now, don't you?
Well, you said it.
Yeah, I know.
Easter.
It's not that complicated. Easter. I'll slap you if I have to.
It wasn't a Good Friday.
It was not Good Friday. He did not die on Friday. Nothing in the Bible says he died on Friday. People get confused because they don't have the Old Testament background I just gave you. So when they read in the New Testament about the day after his crucifixion being a Sabbath, they automatically say, well, Saturday is Sabbath. And so the day after his crucifixion was Saturday, so he had to die on Friday. But since he himself said, a wicked, adulterous generation requires a sign to believe, and there will no sign be given it except the sign of Jonah, as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days, three nights in the belly of the earth. So could he just not count? Or was he confused about what was going to happen? No, he actually, I believe, spent 72 hours in the grave. But there's no way to get 3 days and three nights from Friday, Saturday to Sunday morning. If he was in the grave Friday night and rose Sunday morning, you can't get 3 days, three nights out of that. And no matter how many times people try to say, well, see, Friday was part of a day, all day Saturday, Sunday is part of a day. 3 days, there you go. How do you get three nights out of that? You've got maximum Friday night, Saturday night. So either Jesus was being purposefully obtuse, or the traditional assumption concerning Friday is just flat wrong. And, of course, you know that I argue and have written extensively on our website and laid out a complete chart of everything that took place over the 3 days that he was in the grave. It was actually 72 hours. So Tuesday night, he kept the Passover meal. That night, he was betrayed. Wednesday, he's tried and on the cross. Wednesday, he's taken in front of the Israelites because that's Passover day. And Pontius Pilate says, who do you want to have? Do you want this Jesus? Now, Pilate, interestingly enough, gives every indication that he saw no fault in Jesus. He wanted Jesus to be loosed. You get that impression all the way through the real accounts. And so he thought, well, I know what I'll do. I'll put Jesus up there and the worst guy we can find, this Barabbas, who's a murderer and a seditionist, and there's no way the Israelites will want him. And so they'll take Jesus and my hands are clean of this thing. And instead, they end up saying, give us Barabbas, crucify Jesus. Astounding hatred. So that's Wednesday afternoon. He's in the grave Wednesday night. Wednesday night, Thursday day. Thursday night, Friday day. Friday night, Saturday day. The beginning of Sunday is actually Saturday night. So you've got 72 actual hours. Sunday, when the women came to the tomb at sunup, did they find him getting up?
He's already done.
No, it was empty. The stone was rolled back. He left after 72 hours. When they got there at sunup, the tomb was already empty. So there's just not a problem in the world with, if you just read the Bible, reconciling it with the Old Testament dates of the feasts, recognizing that he fulfilled those feasts, and then you don't have to go through all the tap dancing and machinations of explaining how Friday to Sunday is 3 days and three nights. Just let the Bible say what it says. Chapter 12, verse 1. Now the Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, this month shall be the beginning of months for you. It is to be the first month of the year to you. So now God is saying this event, this moment is so important. Not only do I want you to memorialize it, but I'm even going to change your calendar so that at the beginning of every year, the first feast of your year is the observance of this moment, what I'm about to do. So speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying on the 10th of this month, they are each one of them to take a lamb for themselves, according to their father's households, a lamb for each household. Now, if the household is too small for a lamb, then he and his neighbor nearest to his house are to take one according to the number of persons in them. According to what each man should eat, you are to divide the lamb. Your lamb shall be an unblemished male, a year old. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats, and you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month. And then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel will kill it at twilight. What's twilight? Evening. Okay. So they have to, on the 10th day of the month, go out and find and pick a year-old, unblemished lamb. And then they have to take it home. and keep it in their house for the next 4 days. During which time, it's hard not to grow to like the animal. You know the kids had to have enjoyed a baby lamb. Doesn't get much cuter than that. This is an emblem, this is a symbol of innocence, because not only is it a baby lamb, but it's spotless, it's unblemished. It has no marks on it, it has no sickness. It is a perfect symbol of innocence. On the evening of the 14th, the beginning of the 14th day of Nisan, at twilight, as that day is beginning, the head of the household, the father, the male of the household, was required to take that animal, string it up by its back legs, hang it there in the middle of the house, and slice its neck open, and let the blood bleed out in front of the whole family. That's graphic. That's gruesome. That's a blood atonement of an innocent one, and it was very visceral. It was very real. I don't know if any of you have ever been around here when an animal has bled out, but that's not a pleasant smell. It's not a pleasant image. But they had to do it right there in front of the whole family, I think because God wanted to get their attention. But he's already teaching. Pardon me?
Sorry.
What?
I don't know if any of you have been around here.
Yeah, right before
you. Oh, if any of you have been around.
Yeah, we used to
around here. When
like
the,
like
when
church.
Oh.
Been around when somebody left and not around here.
We don't want people thinking we're killing animals at church.
No, I'm with you. I get it. I get it. But is that what I actually said? I said, is anybody around? Okay. I don't know if you've ever been around a place where animals are being slaughtered. I'm just saying it doesn't smell nice. Let's put it this way. If Elizabeth had a choice between slain animal blood or potpourri, she's going with potpourri. That's all I'm saying. So a very graphic example. Now, God was teaching something very important here, and he was teaching it to the whole family. From the youngest to the oldest, they all had to be in the house and do this, and they were teaching substitutionary atonement. Very important theological concept. A theological concept, by the way, that is, again, unique to Judeo-Christianity. Every other religion in the world says, whatever you do, you're responsible for it, and you pay for it. So work real hard, do good, you get a reward. Don't work hard, you don't get the reward, or you have to go through another cycle of life, or you're going to end up under judgment, whatever the thing is. God, all the way back here with Israel, was teaching that a substitute could atone for, which means to die in the place of, to pay a price for a guilty party. Do you understand? So all the way back here, God is prepping the Israelites for Messiah. He's getting them ready for the concept of Jesus. Now remember, at this moment in Israel's history, they don't have the book of Isaiah. They haven't read anything about the Messiah that's going to come and die in their place. They don't understand any of that. God is giving them the first grade kindergarten lesson right here. This is the beginning of it. Take an innocent, take a spotless, unblemished, perfect innocent, bring it into your house, and kill it. And then take the blood of that animal and put it on your doorpost. And then when the death angel comes to kill the firstborn, if it sees the blood of an innocent, it'll pass by and not kill you. Now all of that is typological. All of that moves into the New Testament and says, now when God looks at you, if he sees the blood, if he sees the blood of his son, if he sees the blood of the perfect sacrifice, if he sees the blood of the one whose death was worth enough to redeem all of God's people forever, when he sees that blood, the death angel can't get you, and the judgment of God passes over you, and you stand forgiven and perfected before God. God's teaching all that way back here to the Israelites. So he tells them, your lamb will be unblemished, a male, a year old. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats. You're going to keep it till the 14th day of the month, and then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel is going to kill it at twilight. Moreover, they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel or the crossbeam of the houses in which they live and in which they're going to eat it. So they have to take the blood of the lamb, put it on the door of their house, shut the door, go inside, and eat the body of the lamb. You'll eat the flesh of it that night, roasted with fire, and they shall eat it with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. Do not eat any of it raw or boiled at all in water, but rather it shall be roasted in fire, both its head and its legs, along with its entrails, and you shall not leave any of it until the morning. But whatever is left of it until the morning, you will burn that with fire. Now you shall eat in this manner. Now he's saying, okay, now we know what you're going to eat. We know how you're going to prepare it. Now God says, when you eat it, you got to have your shoes on your feet. You got to be fully dressed. You got to have your walking stick in your hand. In other words, get ready to go. Be prepared to leave because I'm going to deliver you this very night. First, you're going to stop and recognize substitutionary atonement. Something's going to die in your place because tonight the death angel is coming and all the firstborn of Egypt are going to die. That's going to happen. Once you know that lesson, get prepared because now that I've passed over you, I'm going to deliver you out of this bondage, which is a type of redemption. We talked about redemption last week. We've talked about redemption on Sunday mornings. Redemption, very simply, very basically, is somebody having the sufficient price to come and get the thing they want, pay the price, and take it with them. That's all redemption is. So God is saying the price that's going to be paid for you all is blood. Tonight, blood is going to flow that should be yours because you're guilty. But innocents are going to die in your place, and then I'm going to redeem you by that price, take you out of Egypt, out of your bondage, and take you to the land that I promised Abraham because you're mine. You're my people. So now you've got God teaching substitutionary atonement and redemption all in this activity. Here's how you're going to eat it. You will eat it in this manner, says verse 11. With your loins girded, that means dressed. With your sandals on your feet, with your staff or your walking stick in your hand, and you will eat it in haste. You will eat it in a hurry. And then he says, it is the Lord's Passover. That lamb, that meal is the Lord's Passover. And then having called it that, he just leaves that there till he gets them out to the wilderness, gets them to Sinai, and starts explaining the bigger picture. At this moment, all they know is do it. For I will go through the land of Egypt on that night, and I will strike down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast. And here's that verse that I've pointed out several times, that all of these plagues that God has brought against Egypt were ultimately against the gods of Egypt. Because he says, I will go through the land and take all the firstborn of man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. I am the Lord. So God is saying one more time, I'm going to cause so much pain, so much heartache in this night. I'm going to bring about the death of the firstborn in all of Egypt. And their gods are not going to be any help to them. They're going to weep and moan and cry and pray. They're going to run to their gods. They're going to hope their gods can help them. And nobody's going to be able to stop me because I am proving that I am the Lord. And there is none other. Now, for weeks, I've been saying it's important that we get to know God. That's what I was getting at Sunday morning. It's important that we get to know God because folks have this very fairy tale Mother Goose version of God in their head where they think the only way that God can prove himself is if God does good. You know, I'll believe that God is God if he does me some good. Give me a bigger house, give me a new car, give me a thing, and then I'll go, well, okay, you can be my God because you've done good things. But among the inhabitants of the earth and the armies of heaven, God does whatever he wants. No one can stop his hand. Nobody can ask him, what are you doing? And one of the ways that God proves that he is God, the only God, is that he brings about trouble, catastrophe, famines, floods, earthquakes. All this stuff that God does in order to prove he's God and he's the only God. We don't like to think about the God of heaven as being a God who would say, I'm going to prove I'm the Lord by killing children. That's a dark image of God. But it also shows you that every person born belongs to God. And you're going to see him tell the Israelites, as he's doing here, the death is coming, and here's how you avoid it. The judgment is coming, and you avoid it through a substitute, an innocent substitute, who will die and shed his blood on your behalf, and that's how you avoid the death. All of that is great New Testament typology. You're going to avoid the judgment and death of God through the death of Christ the innocent, who sheds his blood in your place. God's teaching this all the way back here in advance. But he doesn't tell any Egyptian how to avoid it. So is that fair? In our concept of God and the fairness of God, we have to make sure that we define God the way he defines himself. And one of the ways he defines himself is, I have the right to do whatever I want with whatever I make because it's all mine, and therefore for my own glory. To make sure that the earth knows that I am the Lord and I am the only God, I have the absolute right to do things that are really, in many ways, hard to think about. Can you think about what it had to have been like that night in Egypt? When you think about the amount of death and the amount of hurting parents and mothers crying and the screaming through the night, animals and beasts dropping dead if they were the firstborn. I mean, there's death everywhere, except in certain houses, there's the blood of the lamb on a door and the people inside are eating, fully dressed, ready to leave. With, by the way, the wealth of Egypt that they've gone around and borrowed, and the gold and the silver and the clothes. So in the very same night, there's death and judgment and deliverance and blessing. And it's the same God doing both of these things for his glory. Now, if you can't conceive of God that way, you still don't have a biblical conception of God. Because if you understand that he's perfectly willing to judge and perfectly willing to make his power known, then it's all the more amazing that he loved you.
That's right.
It's all the more amazing that he said, yeah, but this one, I'm going to tell. These over here, I'm not going to tell. And they're going to fall under my hand of judgment. But this one, I'm going to tell them how to avoid the judgment. Not only am I going to tell him, I'm going to wake up his mind and heart in such a way that he's going to be able to believe what I tell him. And then I'm going to give him the faith to trust what I'm telling him, and he'll never fall under my hand of judgment. But that's the way he's always been. He hasn't changed one iota. He's always been like that. So get to know him. All right? Yes, ma'am.
God does open your heart and let you believe and actually see and understand his word, would there be a chance that you would not be one of the chosen people of his?
No. The only people that he would approach would, of course, be those people who he has chosen, because those are the people he sent his son to die for. So, no, to say that there could be any confusion or that God by mistake opened the heart and mind of someone he didn't mean to is to say that God is prone to accidents or mistakes. And remember on Sunday we looked at the verses like, known unto God are all his ways from the beginning. He knows what he's going to do, and then he does it. For him to have to change his mind about anything is to say that he was wrong when he first thought it. And then he had to change his mind and go, oh, I didn't see that coming. Whoops, what was I thinking? Well, it's kind of hard to trust a God like that. It's like, well, I sent my son to die for Rick. Wait, what was that? I didn't mean to do that. No, I didn't mean Rick. I meant Pam, and he was in the local area, and he got in by mistake. You know, God doesn't work that way. So then he says this, verse 13, well, verse 12. I will go through the land of Egypt on that night. I will strike down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. I am the Lord. And the blood on the doorpost, and the blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you live, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you, and no plague will befall you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. So he tells the Israelites very specifically, here's what you got to do. I'm going to. Now, they've seen all these other plagues. They've seen everything else that has occurred. They know that this God is fighting for them. They have every reason to believe when Moses says, trust me on this one, get a lamb, kill it, trust me. Spread some blood on the doorpost and the lintel of your house, and then shut that door and go in and eat. Trust me on this one, because he's going to kill the firstborn tonight. And so all of Israel faithfully does this, which means two things. It means, number one, that they heard the word of God and they believed it. But they didn't just hear the word of God and then sit back and go, well, as long as I believe it, that's good. They heard the word of God and then they had to act on what they believed. They had to actively put their body on what they believed. Life or death for them, for their children, at that moment, was dependent on them acting on what they believed. If they sat inside and said, I believe the blood can save me, but didn't put the blood on the door, that's not good enough. You have to be convinced that the word of God is true, and then they had to hang their bodies on it. And you know that I have oftentimes defined faith exactly that way. Should we do it again? Should we do the faith example? Sure, why not? You want to help me? That's what I thought. Okay, let's do it. Okay. Josh, this is a chair. Do you agree?
Sure.
Do you think that chair could hold you?
Yes.
If you were to sit on that chair, do you think it could hold you?
Yes, sir.
What if you stood on that chair? Do you think that chair could hold you?
Yes, sir.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. Yeah, very polite, by the way, and I appreciate that. Okay, so Josh is convinced that this chair can hold him if he sits on it. He's convinced it could hold him if he stood on it. Has he so far demonstrated faith?
No.
We had some yeses, some no's. We had some yeses, no's.
Maybe.
We have a maybe in this corner of the room.
we have
someone. That's what he's done. So far, as Alex just said, he has given intellectual assent to the idea. I do agree that that's a chair, and I do agree that it could hold me. But until he puts his body on it, he's yet to exercise what the Bible calls actual faith.
Yes.
Sit in the chair. There. Not only did he see... Oh, you got a hand for sitting down. That is so impressive. Week after week, I knock myself out to be here with plenty of good content. You got a hand for sitting down. Okay? So my point is this. He could look at that chair all day long and say, I believe that chair could hold me. I believe that if I stood on the chair... Here, stand on the chair. I believe that if I stand on the chair, it could hold me. He admitted in front of all of us, he believes that could happen. But until he actually put his body on it, he had not done what the Bible defines as faith. So it's not enough to just say, I believe Jesus could save me, which is how many, many people approach the question of Christianity. I give mental assent to the concept that if Jesus is the Son of God, he could save me. That's not faith, and it's not going to do you any good in the courts of heaven. You have to be so convinced of it that you're ready to thrust yourself out into eternity on nothing more than the promise of God that the finished work of Christ is sufficient to save you. And you don't get to take your works, and you don't get to take anything that's in you. You got to leave all that behind and really genuinely throw yourself wholly and completely on what it is you believe. It's not enough to just say, I believe he could save me. You have to live and die like he has saved you. You understand the difference? You may now go. A hand for Josh, ladies and gentlemen.
You know, a lot of times there's people that we talk to who are very agreeable
right to
Christianity and to us and our faith. And sometimes we assume that they too are believers, and that's right, not the case.
No, it's not.
Pam and I had an interesting incident where we bumped into an older lady sitting out on her front porch, or she came out on her front porch in her house next to where Pam's sister has bought a house. And I forgot exactly how it unfolded, but somewhere in the conversation, you know, she indicated her faith and belief in the Lord, and we were agreeable to that. But she took it a step further to ask us if we had actually committed ourselves to him.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't just assume, because of our agreeableness, Mm-hmm. We were okay.
Right. And it was wise, wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Does everybody understand the example? Now, the reason that I had Josh come up here and stand on the chair is that you're not likely to forget that. If I had just thrown a concept out at you, you'd say, well, I think I get the concept. So you did very well tonight. When people say, so what'd you do yesterday? You say, I demonstrated faith. And they'll all be very impressed.
I sat on a chair.
I said, well, no, you don't say I stood on a chair. No.
Yeah, I said,
no.
Jumped on it.
So verse 14, God says, this day, he's changed their calendar. They've told them to get ready, kill the lamb, be inside, be ready to eat, put the blood on the door. Now this day will be a memorial to you, and you shall celebrate it as a feast or a set time to the Lord throughout your generations. You are to celebrate it as a permanent ordinance. So does any of that language in there sound like this is temporary? No, he said, you're going to keep this as a memorial, as a permanent ordinance. Later when he gets them to Sinai, he's going to be emphatic about it. You're going to do this through all your generations. Because as they kept it year by year by year, they were continuing to teach substitutionary atonement, redemption, deliverance. And so when Messiah appears on the stage of history, after Isaiah has added the language of and theology of substitutionary atonement and a Messiah that would die and raise again and rule, and through the years that they're doing this and the revelation of God, who he is and what he's like, continues to grow, Jesus then walks on the stage of history and dies on Passover and is in the grave on unleavened bread and rises on first fruit. I mean, this is just so big that none of his early followers missed it. They all got it and pointed to it to say, he has to be Messiah. Look what just happened. He just fulfilled what we've been doing for 1,400 years. And it all worked out exactly right. So that's why you see language like, behold the Lamb of God, or I am the bread of heaven, he's the first fruit of the resurrection. All that language is purposeful because the New Testament writers are reaching back to this event and saying, he's fulfilling all this stuff that God set up all that time in advance. And as I like to point out, and will again, a God who can do that with that kind of specificity, that many years in advance, that's a God who can get you through this winter. That's a God who can help you with your bills. That's a God who knows about your sickness. That's a God who is in such determinate counsel about what happens in his universe that he already knows the next big worry you've got around the corner, and he's already got a way prepared to get you through it. You understand? So verse 15, this is the beginning of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. 7 days you will eat unleavened bread. But on the first day, you shall remove the leaven from your houses. For whoever eats anything leavened from the first day until the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. That's how important this was to God. For a whole week, I want you guys to understand the typology of sin and sinless bread. Unleavened bread. So that when Christ comes on the stage of history and says, I am that bread, they would go, that actually makes sense to me because we've been doing that for all this time. Verse 16, and on the first day of that 7 days, on that first day you shall hold a holy assembly, and then another holy assembly on the seventh day. No work at all shall be done on those days except what must be eaten by every person. That alone may be prepared by you. You shall also observe the Feast of Unleavened Bread, for on this very day I brought your hosts out of the land of Egypt. Therefore you shall observe this day throughout your generations as a permanent ordinance. God wanted this planted in stone. Not only does he tell them this and then give them the demonstration of the death angel, when he gets them to Sinai, he writes it into their law. He says, keep doing this because I'm teaching you something. Verse 18, in the first month, on the 14th day of the month, at evening, you shall eat unleavened bread until the 21st day of the month at evening. 7 days there shall be no leaven found in your houses. For whoever eats what is leavened, that person shall be cut off from the congregation of Israel, whether he is an alien or a native of the land. You shall not eat anything leavened in all your dwellings. You shall eat unleavened bread. Then Moses called for all the elders of Israel and said to them, go and take for yourselves lambs according to your families and slay the Passover lamb. And you shall take a bunch of hyssop and dip it in the blood which is in the basin and apply some of the blood that is in the basin to the lintel and to the doorposts. And none of you shall go outside the door of his house until morning. For the Lord will pass through to smite the Egyptians. And when he sees the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, the Lord will pass over that door and will not allow the destroyer to come into your houses to smite you. And you will observe this event as an ordinance for you and your children forever. And it will come about when you enter the land which the Lord will give you, as he has promised, that you shall observe this rite, this ritual. And it will come about when your children will say to you, what does this mean? Why do we do this every year? You will say, it is a Passover, a sacrifice to the Lord, who passed over the houses of the sons of Israel in Egypt when he smote the Egyptians. But he spared our homes, and the people bowed low, and they all worshiped. Then the sons of Israel went and did just as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron, so they did. Now it came about at midnight that the Lord struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh, who sat on his throne, to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of the cattle. And Pharaoh arose in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was no home where there was not someone dead. Then he called for Moses and Aaron in the night, and he said, rise up, get out from among my people, both you and the sons of Israel, and go worship the Lord, as you have said. Take both your flocks and your herds, as you have said, and go and bless me also. And the Egyptians urged the people to send them out of the land in haste, for they said, we shall all be dead. So the people took their dough before it was leavened, with their kneading bowls bound up under their clothes on their shoulders. And now the sons of Israel had done according to the word of Moses, for they had requested from the Egyptians articles of silver and articles of gold and clothing, and the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they let them have everything they requested, and thus they plundered the Egyptians. Now the sons of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, aside from all the children, and a mixed multitude also went up with them, along with flocks and herds, a very large number of livestock. And they baked the dough which they had brought out of Egypt into cakes of unleavened bread, for it had not become leavened, since they were driven out of Egypt, and they could not delay, nor had they prepared any provisions for themselves. Now the time that the sons of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years, and it came about at the end of 430 years to the very day that all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. Okay, so let's review. When God talked to Abraham, Abraham said, how do I know I'm going to inherit this land? You should have all heard this enough times that you know it intimately. What did God give as an answer to that question?
400 years. Going into Egypt and to a land you're not known, live there for 400 years, and I'll bring you out with a mighty hand.
Exactly. So he said, how do I know this is going to be my land? And God says, well, you're going to die, and then I'm going to take your descendants into a land where they're not known. And there I'm going to make them a mighty nation, and they're going to serve them there for 400 years. And then I'm going to bring them back out and bring them to this very land. And when I do that, that's when you'll know that this really is your land. Because God gives very big answers to small questions. So God is keeping the promise he made to Abraham, and Moses is specific to say, 430 years, and he delivered them out. So once again, we're talking about a God who has set times, very specific moments, very specific calendar dates, very specific years. And you get into the New Testament, and he still talks that way. And Paul still writes things like, after the times of the Gentiles. How often have we heard that phrase? The times of the Gentiles. See it in the Old Testament, see it in the New Testament. Times of the Gentiles. What does that mean? That means God has a set time during which he's dealing with Gentiles. And Paul says, when the fullness of the Gentiles be come in, then all Israel will be saved. What does that mean, fullness of the Gentiles? It means he knows how many that is, and when he hits that number's full, and that's when he does the next thing he's going to do. It's still the same God dealing the exact same way, still saying, I'm going to do specific things at specific times for specific numbers. You get into the book of Revelation, and he gets into 3.5 years, which he then calls 42 months, which he then calls 1,260 days. Really specific. Like, look, do the math. Whichever way you want to divide it, that's how long it's going to be when I do that. As far as I can tell, he hasn't done it yet. When he does it, guess how long it'll take? 3.5 years. I mean, he said it over and over. So this is a God who deals in very specific times, places, names, people. The more you go through the Bible, the more you find that kind of detail and specificity. I said all that to say this. If you're here now, at this stage in your life, at this moment, because you know who the Lord is and he has captivated you and he's captured you and drawn you to himself, you are then right where he wants you in exactly the time he wants you as he shows you the things he wants to show you, because he has always only been one way. And the way he is real, real specific over and over again. And he didn't lose that ability to be specific, which means what he's dealing with you is quite specific. You say, well, I don't like his specificity. This hurts. Yeah, well, 40 years in the wilderness probably wasn't a lot of fun either. But he did it. Right? So whatever he's putting you through now, it's on purpose. It's the same question that we were just asked. And Kristen said, you know, could he make a mistake in picking somebody or putting his spirit in somebody? No, everything he does completely on purpose. You never find a place anywhere in the Bible where God is not working on purpose and saying, I do everything according to my purpose. And all things work together for good to those who love the Lord, who are the called according to his purpose. It's all about his purpose. He is not purposeless, he's purposeful, and he is doing everything according to his purpose. So wherever you're at right now, you're there on purpose. And he's going to take you from where you are to wherever he's going to take you next. And he's going to get glory from it, because on purpose, he's in the enterprise of glorifying himself. And you sure see it here, don't you? I'm delivering my people, and I am punishing my enemies, and I'm doing it all in one night. And I'm teaching redemption through the blood of an innocent, and I'm teaching judgment for those people I didn't choose. And it's all right there. We all kind of grew up knowing the Exodus story. Oh, yeah, the Exodus. Yeah, that's when he delivered the children of Israel. Oh, yeah, we know that one. But there's all this theology in it. There's all this great revelation of God in it. And it's all God being exactly the same way God always is, which is absolutely sovereign. That's how he is. Got all that?
Yep.
Now, as we continue into this, by the way, you're going to see that it's going to say that as they left, there was nobody among them halt, lame, blind, nobody had any sickness. No, wait, you're talking like a million people at this moment leaving. What are the chances that just nobody happened to be sick at that moment? You're talking about slaves who were working with large stones and bricks and everything. What are the chances nobody got hurt? 40 years they march in the wilderness, and the leather of their shoes never wears out. And because they're all wearing cloaks and garments, none of their clothes wear out for 40 years. And God gives them bread to eat from heaven every single day, faithfully every day. But every Friday, he gives them enough that they can pick up enough for 2 days. But if they pick up enough for 2 days any other day, when they get up the next day, it stinks and is full of worms. How does the bread know? How does the bread know which calendar day it is?
Very smart.
It's a very smart bread.
Memory bread.
Memory bread.
It went to Harvard, low carb.
Yeah, so So God is going to take these people out into the wilderness and for 40 years do the miraculous among them, to say nothing of the whole Red Sea event. And they are going to rebel, and they are going to argue, and they're going to try to argue that they should go back to Egypt, that somehow it was better in their slave days. And then God is going to take that whole first generation who received the law and leave their bones in the wilderness. And it's going to be that second generation, the delivered generation. We've seen this all the way through the book of Genesis and Exodus, haven't we? It's always the younger son. It's always the second one, because it's that new covenant that's going to be the one that actually delivers the promise. So we're going to see all that still to come. There is so much rich, thick theology in these passages that it amazes me that people can read it and just say, well, that was a good story, wasn't it? There's all this great teaching built into it. All right, anything else? I have to stop because I'll just keep talking. Yes.
Is there a significance in the fact that God chose the firstborn of Egypt to kill rather than just, you know, a random group or something like that?
Yeah, there's a significance to it in two ways. The first is, as we already read, he told Moses that Egypt was responsible for keeping Israel, who he calls my firstborn. Okay. But then once he gets Israel out into the wilderness, he's going to say, since I didn't kill your firstborn, all your firstborn belong to me. Then he's going to say, but rather than how confusing that would be to figure out which firstborn animal, which firstborn child, which firstborn, instead I'm just going to take to myself one of the tribes of Israel. And he picks the tribe of Levi, again, just choosing, just picking and choosing, and says, okay, now Levi, I chose you, and therefore you don't get any land inheritance when you get to the land. When you get to Canaan, no land inheritance for you. Which would make them kind of all go, oh, wait, we're going to march all the way there and get nothing. And then he says, now the other tribes, 1/10 of everything they produce goes to Levi. Which if you do the math, means, you know, 10% from 11 tribes is 110%. Which means they end up with more than they would have had if they've had some land. But they belong to God, so their whole lives are devoted to the service of God. And so God knew he was going to do that in advance too. So when you say, is there significance to not taking the firstborn? Yes, he uses that to create his priesthood. Keep connecting dots. Keep connecting. Yes, ma'am.
Whenever they killed the firstborn, was it the firstborn of every family household in a dwelling, or was it firstborn of every generation?
Seemed to be the firstborn of every family, which means even if you were 60 years old, but you were your firstborn in your family, gone.
Because then that seems like there could be more than one death in each.
Right, and it said there was death in every house, but yes, because every house would have one person in it that was a firstborn somewhere, yeah.
So you could,
Yes, what? You know, just keep talking.
If
we're fine.
If the father of that house was the firstborn of his family, and then...
Yeah, and he had a firstborn child, they would have both died. That's why I kept stressing, can you imagine how emotional this night had to be? The Israelites are in there eating, and they're hearing wailing and crying and screaming in the streets. So... Yes?
Two things. Say the firstborn wasn't alive, they had passed or something, would it just be not one from that particular family, or then would it go on to the second?
You're asking technical questions I can't answer. What we know for sure is how much the Bible has said so far, but when you try to create the what-if scenarios,
right.
Jump ball. Your guess is as good as mine.
And you were saying how, sometimes in situations people almost want God to do something good.
Right.
To kind of prove it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Doesn't that take the whole purpose out of having faith?
Well, yeah, I agree. If you only trust God because of what good you get out of it, then as soon as something bad comes, you're going to abandon God, right? So, of course, it takes faith to endure the bad stuff that happens in life because you have to trust that God is working this for your ultimate good. So, yes, I agree that the bad parts build your faith. To give you a better example, do people spend more time in fervent prayer when things are going good or when things are going bad? Yeah. When the kids are healthy and the wolf's away from the door and the bills are paid, you're on vacation, you're not spending a lot of time on your knees. But, let a kid get sick and you can't make your mortgage and you're doing some praying. So, yes, God very frequently uses trouble to build faith. Absolutely. That was a very astute question, by the way. It was better than your first one. First one, second one, good question. Anything else? All right, it's really good to see all of you tonight. I appreciate you being here during the Christmas season like this. I'm leaving. I'll be back here for Sunday, but I'm leaving tomorrow morning. I'm going to go see my mom and my siblings. For those of you on the internet, if I haven't answered your email, you're not getting one this weekend either. Boy, I've gotten a lot of email lately. So we'll see you all here hopefully Sunday, except those of you who are traveling. And I hope everybody has a very blessed time of family and food and friends and fellowship, and get me something nice. Okay? So.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.